Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling. And today I have a wonderful hang out with John Forte. John, welcome, welcome, welcome to Mind
Rolling. Thank you, Raghu. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
So many of you will know that John is closely associated and was part of the Fugees with Wycliffe and Lauryn Hill and Prez, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And the refugee camp, the Fugees, you know, refugees, Fugees.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most unique hip-hop rap groups of all time and a major influence for many of the people that you hear out there right now. And yeah, we'll get into that later. But I guess we should, what I really want is to start out with where you're from and how you grew up and the kind of environment that you were dealing with at the time. So can you, I know you grew up in Brownsville, right?
New York? Yeah, I grew up in Brownsville, Brooklyn. There's also Brownsville, Texas. I'm sure there are many other Brownsville scattered throughout these here United States. But I'm from Brownsville, Brooklyn. Single parent at home. My mom, Flo, is my best homie. I spoke to her a little while ago. We speak regularly.
Is she still in New York?
She's in New Jersey. She's been in New Jersey for 20 years now. Mm. She raised my older sister Natasha and me on her own, very, very heroically and bravely, at a time when it was tough for a lot of folks, not only in the neighborhood but in the country, you know, in the 70s and 80s. So you know, Brownsville definitely was and remains to this day to be an underserved community. And so resources were scarce, but the love was thick and heavy, and you felt community. So I can't take anything away from that. I had a very, very happy childhood, although there was some traumatic occurrences within a very, very traumatic environment.
Mm, yeah. And going to school, and by the way, I took a look. I love this. You did an interview, I guess, last year with Talib Kweli, who is a good friend. I know that, and so I heard him. You mentioned there that you were actually sent to a gifted school that was a little, mm-hmm. that was far away. Yeah, describe that, because you were 7-8 years old and having to do something that was a little bit scary, right?
Sure. The zone school, PS 183, was two blocks away from where I grew up on Legion Street between Riverdale and Livonia in Brownsville. And I remember that first day of class, I went to I guess my homeroom, and we had some exercises, and there was some reading exercises in particular, and I was pulled out of that class immediately and told to go to the principal's office, and I wasn't told why I was in the principal's office. And the next thing I know, my mom showed up, and I thought, what did I do? I'm in some serious trouble. And she went in and she spoke to the principal and my teacher, and there was this meeting on my behalf, and I was none the wiser about the subject, or the topic beyond me, right? And so when my mom came out, before she could even speak, I was already apologizing. I didn't do it. I don't know what they're telling you in there.
Yeah, right.
And my mom came out, and you know, she had a stoic expression. It was neither happy nor upset. You could tell she was processing, and even then, as a kid, I could tell you know, she was mulling whatever this conversation was over in her head before she spoke to me about it. And when she finally did summarize it for me, she said, this school said that they don't have anything to offer you, that that you've aced their tests, and they'd like to offer or they'd like to suggest another school that could serve you and serve us better. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Where is it? And she said, that's the issue. It's a little farther away. And so it wasn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles to get to, but it was taking a New York City bus at the age of 8 with an older friend of mine from the neighborhood that we found out was also, you know, at the same school. You know, I think she was 10, April. That's her name, April. I remember April. What is up, April? And April was my buddy, you know, and so we would take the bus from one side of town to the other in order to get to this school that had a gifted and talented program. And that's when I picked up, you know, so many other things. You know, the violin was really.
Yeah, that's amazing. That I didn't know. Are you still playing, by the way?
Am I still playing? I'm not still playing the violin in the traditional sense, but I'm doing a lot of scoring work with strings. Uh-huh. And so that scoring work and that production work is, you know, a clear and direct result of that tutelage.
Hmm. Yeah. And, okay, so the next thing that happens is you went off to Phillips Exeter, right? Boarding school. And then, so again, I was just listening. Talib said, yeah, you went to the high-end boarding school. I went to a low-end school called Cheshire Academy. I just about dropped off my chair. I went to Cheshire
Academy. That's your alma mater. Uh-huh.
And he said, yes, it's a low end on the food chain of private schools. I only went there because I was such a screwed up delinquent.
Oh, we're so connected. I love it.
I couldn't believe it.
God. You and Talib were sitting at the same desk somewhere, walking the same.
Yeah, well, I'm a little older than he is. So
but again,
the same desk. Yeah,
yes. You know that energy. Inherited.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. Oh my. So
yeah, I went to boarding school. It was from Brownsville, Brooklyn, and next thing you know, I'm walking paths with manicured lawns and saying hi to strangers.
Yeah,
which is something that we didn't do in my hometown. You didn't speak to people you didn't know.
Yeah, right. Not to mention, okay, I don't remember people of color at Cheshire. I don't know about Phillips Exeter. Maybe by the time you went, which is much later, there were people of color, but was there?
Not many.
Not many.
Not many, right? A small percent. I mean, yeah. Very, very small percent. And, you know, you had societies, you had clubs that allowed for those kids who were different to celebrate their differences together. And and those clubs were vital and critical, in my opinion, of that experience. You know, were it not for those clubs that allowed you to have the safest spaces on those campuses, and would then encourage you, you know, to coexist, and would give you the tools to do it in a fashion that would allow for you to thrive. It was a deep education on a number of levels.
Hmm. And for the most part, you felt that there was enough of an openness to be yourself there? Or is that a reach?
No, it's not a reach at all. I started growing my hair sophomore year. And, you know, I didn't cut it until 37 years later. But it was growing that hair that was my connection an ancestral identity and a spiritual depth. But I think about, you know, in doing that gesture, which felt very, very necessary for me at the time in that environment, was that, you know, was that met with much resistance? This is getting to your question. No, it wasn't. And it may seem like a small gesture, but it clearly meant enough for me to stick with it for 37 years. But what, you know, it was the seed that was planted there. And a seed can only grow if it's got the right conditions in order to do so. So I think that the Academy, because I can only speak about my experience at that Academy, I can't speak about the experience of Black folk en masse in these institutions, but, you know, in my experience, the Academy did real work in order to celebrate that individualism as we came together collectively to learn and to grow. You know, our motto was non sibi, which is Latin for, you know, not for self. And there was a real emphasis at Phillips Exeter to participate in the community, to show up for community, to be in it for more than just for yourself.
Okay, that's tremendous to hear this, especially when I remember, okay, here's what I ended up doing. First of all, looking for whatever drugs I could find, you know, at 14, 15 years old, 16, whatever it was. And that wasn't so easy back then. And then second thing is that I got into a snowball. This is really dumb. A snowball fight with what we call townies, right? We call the townies, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, townies as well.
For me, unfortunately,
we too knew townies.
Yeah. Unfortunately for me, the vice principal happened to be going, walking down that street just behind where I was throwing.
Oh.
I hit him, and he threw me out right away. Gone.
Really?
Yeah, I got. Expelled for a month or something like that. And if you can imagine having to go home and explain that to your parents. So this was my life. I was pretty much ruined at school from the get-go. And
did you stick around thereafter? Did you go to, did you stay in school?
Or yeah, I graduated by the skinny of my teeth because somebody, I had a really great math tutor, a teacher who I shouldn't have passed, but he got me passed.
all praise.
Yeah.
All praise.
Yeah. So, you know, what one does with one's circumstances is an interesting thing. When you think about the causes and conditions that formulate our lives.
Again and again.
Yeah. And, you know, yours is a good example and mine is not such a good one. But I was saved in the end. I was saved.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. God. Oh, by the way, everybody, I will be chastised for not telling everyone about the fact that John is going to join our Ram Dass Soulland music series. I believe it's April 29th, but go to ramdass.org/music and you'll see the whole lineup, which starts, it runs from mid-March through the end of April.
And our date is April the 30th.
30th. That was close. Yes. 30th. Okay, everybody, April 30th. And we're really, really happy that you're doing this with us.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I'm feeling so much joy to be introducing myself to this community, to have the opportunity to do so. And you know, this is our first sort of public conversation.
Yeah.
But there's so much connectivity here, and so there's this explosion of you know, it's just happiness of being here now. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So you get out of school, and obviously you were drawn to music. And yeah, a little bit about how you even ended up, you know, meeting the Fugees and meeting, actually, Lauryn Hill, I think, was instrumental. But wasn't there somebody before all of that that was kind of started taking you around, a sort of mentor, Jessica? I think her name was.
There was so many. I've got so many heroes and mentors and guides and advisors. When I think about the folks who held my hand through this journey thus far, it's not a short list. Mm. Not a short list. Musically, you talk about me being drawn to it. It doesn't even feel like that. It feels like we were never apart.
Mm.
My journey with music has been the relationship of having it, experiencing it, seeing it morph and take on different colors and shapes, and it showed me from a very, very early age that collaboration was going to be the key for the source of my continued inspiration. Working with others, finding that harmony. And so I've been collaborating long before folks knew that they were that I was in the band. You know, I was playing along miles and miles and miles away. But that's the spirit of it. The spirit of music is community. It's community and communication. It's air itself.
Hmm. But who were a couple of the people that brought you into that particular scene?
Yes. So while I was away at boarding school, I was coming home on, you know, certain vacations, but particularly during the summertime. So being at a boarding school in New England still gave me access to New York City. So I was growing up in New England during the school year, but growing up in New York City during the summer times, which was everything, which was the amalgamation of all beautiful worlds for me. So when I came home during those, predominantly during those summer vacations, because they were the longest, I was out and about. I was soaking up the city. I was with my backpack in Washington Square Park with the likes of Talib Kweli on one side and Mos Def, who's now Yasiin Bey, on the other. And we were kids learning how to play with language and rhythm. And we were also kids who weren't, I won't say we were also kids who weren't, I would say we were also kids who were connected to our academic institutions. So we showed up with our backpacks, and in those backpacks, more often than not, happened to be, you know, the books that we were reading, Paulo Freire and Frantz Fanon. And so we were, you know, we were educating ourselves and then passing that literature around and then incorporating that into our rhymes. And so we became a generation known as the backpack rappers, you know, where, you know, you speak about the individualism or one's individualism, individuality being celebrated. That's precisely what that was all about. We showed up in that park. We were superheroes. We could be anything we wanted to be. And that's what that energy felt like, you know, and that's what happened during the daytime. And during the nighttime, we ran into the clubs. And this was at a time in the late 80s, early 90s in New York City, when large amounts of folks came together. You're talking about 5,000 people in the Palladium, you know, about 2,500 people in the tunnel, Sound Factory Bar, Mars, which was an entire building on the west side and had four floors. Every floor was its own different music. And so we were kids hopping around in that nightlife, too young to get in, but figuring out how to get in nonetheless. And it was in that experience that, yes, you speak about one of my mentors, guides, a woman who became my manager, her name's Jessica Rosenblum. And back in the days, Jessica, she was responsible for throwing the best. And I don't like to speak hyperbolic in a hyperbolic fashion normally, but she threw the best downtown hip hop parties. And I have to specify downtown because that's what it was all about. It was about bringing hip hop to downtown at the time, which it wasn't necessarily downtown Manhattan, which it was pretty alienated until, you know, pioneers like Jessica figured out how to work with those club owners. And so, you know, she was a club promoter turned a manager of a DJ, and she also managed me. And it was, you know, through her guidance and, you know, that I was able to record my first record when I was 15. Oh. It was with another person that she represented at the time, then an unknown DJ named Funkmaster Flex, who was just getting this started, a few clubs. And Jessica said, all right, you know, we'll figure this out. And they cracked the code. They really unlocked it. And I was part of that scene.
And then another very important person, surely is Lauryn Hill for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. It was actually in hanging out in Jessica's office one day that our friend Jeff Burrows, he came in. He was a product manager at Sony, and he came in. He had a video cassette, a VHS. And he said, this is the future of music right here. He was waving it. What are you talking about? And he popped it in, and it was black and white video of two guys and one girl. And they were singing a song called Boof Bath. And it was very, very high energy. And I remember thinking, there's a lot going on here. You could just feel it, right? The energy was palpable. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, if you like what you've just saw, they're playing tonight at the Supper Club in Midtown, 47th Street, I think. And I went up to see their show. And that was the first night that I met Lauryn, after waiting on their meet and greet line and just introducing myself and speaking to her for a few minutes. We realized then and there that we had a lot in common. Hmm. And we became fast friends.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing artist. And
that she is.
I know this was brought up, but what happened? I mean, this is aside from everything else, but what happened with Lauryn in terms of just leaving it? I mean, at one point she just left it. I think she came back.
I don't know if she ever left music. She left the industry. Mm. And, but you know, Lauryn's a creator. Without knowing what she's created over the time, I know in my heart of hearts that she's never stopped communicating through that language of music, which is fundamental to our existence.
Hmm. Hmm. So then next thing, and this is where I'm first aware of you in any way, which was, that amazing record, The Score, that the Fugees did.
The Score.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Okay, all you guys out there, if you have not heard this, please go to Spotify and stream it. You know, it's Killing Me Softly.
The 25th anniversary this
year.
Oh,
really? Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Must make you feel a little bit older.
A little bit. Just a little bit.
But I don't know if you all remember the Roberta Flack song, Killing Me Softly.
No. No one will remember.
No. Okay. All right. Well, take it from us. It's a phenomenal song. And what you did, John, because you produced that track. I know.
I didn't produce Killing Me Softly. I produced a remix of Killing Me Softly.
No, that's what I mean.
Which is now floating around out there. Uh-huh. But it wasn't the one on the record. No. Uh-huh. I produced a couple of tracks off of that album. I produced Family Business. I produced Cowboys, which I'm also rapping on. I did drum programming on No Woman, No Cry.
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah, that Marley song. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Anyhow, check it out, y'all. I mean, that record is pretty phenomenal and was a huge, huge hit and big moment in hip hop for sure.
It was quite a moment.
Yeah. So then we go to the, before we started, I said to John, I know I'm going to have to ask you about the incarceration deal, and you've told it a billion times. And he said,
dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. Okay, what happened? What happened? You were doing really well, right? Yeah. And tell us from there.
I was doing great. I was on top of the world. The Fugees, aligning with them, having that opportunity to see places I'd never dreamed, to be nominated for the Grammy for producing on that album. It was a moment. I was 21 with my mom next to me at the Grammys. And then the year after that, Wyclef comes out with his solo album. Wyclef Presents the Carnival, which is a huge success. And there's the second single off of that is a song called We're Trying to Stay Alive, which takes the old Staying Alive, John Travolta, the Staying Alive Bee Gees track.
Yeah.
We repurposed that. And so that was also a big moment for me because it further highlighted me in and a part of the community. There were collaborations that came and production opportunities, and all the while I'm being groomed for my solo album, which comes out in 1998. And it comes out to critical acclaim, but commercial disappointment. And to put that into mathematical quantifiable terms, I sold about 100,000 copies, which, you know, I have to qualify by today's standards.
Yeah.
Hey, 100,000 copies, hey, that'd be pretty good. But in the 90s, after being, down with the group that sold millions and millions and millions of physical, albums, selling, 100,000 copies was a big failure. And it was my first failure. And I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to process it. I don't know if I did process it. What I did do was blame everyone around me for my failure.
Mm.
Everyone felt the ire of my wrath. But what I did not do was look in the mirror and ask myself what I could have done better. And what I was responsible for. I didn't take much responsibility for that. And that precipitated a series of events that led to my being dropped from the label and on my own. And I said, well, fine, that's all right. There are other folks out there who are finding their way independently. I'll find my way independently. And that was when I met an individual who gave me an opportunity to involve myself in his criminal enterprise. And it didn't just happen overnight. We become friends. We started hanging out, and he saw the opportunity, and then I saw the opportunity. And that's when I started taking risks that would lead to the cataclysmic fall of my house of cards.
So you were arrested, you were sentenced, and talk about a world falling apart. I mean, I can't, I'm thinking about your mom, actually. God, that must have been, I mean, hard for you, going into that situation. But Mom,
I think about mom every day, throughout the day. And you know, it's moments like that that I consider in that equation, too. I know that it wasn't easy for her, to say the least. But she's a woman. She was a woman then, and remains a woman of unwavering faith. When I was arrested at Newark Airport for picking up two couriers who had what was then accounted to be $1.7 million worth of cocaine, 14 kilos. Everything stopped. Everything changed. It was this shift. And a year later, after being on house arrest for a year, waiting to go to trial, I went to trial in Texas. I wasn't arrested in Texas, but because the couriers, unbeknownst to me when I was arrested, the couriers were participating in a controlled delivery. They had already been apprehended. They'd already been working with the feds. And so conversations had been recorded, and they were building a case. Ultimately, the couriers testified against me. The kingpin in the operation, he was arrested on an unrelated charge a few weeks later and said, "Oh, I'll give you my partner, John Forte." I'm like, "Partner?" And so a year later, I was in a court of law in Houston, Texas, with couriers testifying against me and the kingpin testifying against me and me being in the middle. And I was found guilty of the possession charge. I was acquitted of the conspiracy charge. Although originally, and when I tell this story, I'd like to throw in the detail that originally the jury came back. They were deadlocked. And the judge issued an Allen charge, which essentially directs the jurors to do their civic duty and to work it out to reach a verdict, right? Like you've taxpayers have paid for this. I'm gonna really encourage you to go back there and to do the work. And so something like 22 minutes later, they came back with the verdict, which was a compromised verdict, which acquitted me on the conspiracy charge, but found me guilty of the possession charge. And it was first time nonviolent drug offense. But it garnered me 168 months in federal prison, so a 14-year prison sentence. And that was 2001.
Since I come from the hippie era, I had many friends who had similar problems, so I'm quite aware. So people are going to say, "Well, what happened? How did that turn?"
So much. A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah. But it stems from the left turn on the around the music, I would imagine.
The first couple of years of my incarceration, I didn't embrace music. I felt betrayed by the industry. I felt like a lover scorned. And I also didn't want to be perceived as trying to lean on celebrity in that environment. So I didn't want to be a hotshot talking about what it was like to go on tour, or what it was like to be in a party with this person, or if I knew this individual. I didn't reminisce, at least out loud. It wasn't until a dear friend of mine named Rabbit, came to me when I was at my designated facility, Loretto, which is in Western Pennsylvania. And he came to my cell one day and he gave me an acoustic guitar that he had he'd gotten from the recreation department. He'd made a move and had gotten a guitar. I'm like, how did you get this guitar? He's like, don't ask me. I'm out of here. And I'm there with this guitar. And, you know, Rabbit thought that he was doing me this amazing favor, because here he knows me to be this musician. And he thought he was, you know, throwing me a lifeline. And he was, but I didn't realize it then. I was like, what am I supposed to do with this thing? Because I didn't know how to play guitar. I looked at other friends of mine who were out there, but that wasn't my instrument. You know, I programmed drums. I knew how to sample things, and I played violin, but the guitar, no. But a couple few weeks with that instrument taking up space in my limited space, I soon welcomed the conversation with it. And so I asked for friends and family to send me, you know, basic guitar for, or guitar for dummies, or yes, basic guide guitar, you know, and just these tab books, which pretty quickly led to me teaching guitar in prison. Hmm. Even though I only knew how to play two chords at the time. The next thing I knew, I was teaching a guitar class to, you know, 12 guys. And they didn't know or care that I only knew two chords. Because as long as I could teach them one chord, that was enough. And so I started teaching them what I knew as soon as I knew it, rather immediately. And that ultimately very clearly helped me learn faster, more passionately, more profoundly. It was more purposefully.
Wow. So from being thrown off the cliff in the music business to it reviving you in that circumstance is pretty amazing karma.
Well, the business didn't, right? You know, it wasn't the business. It's the music. It's the continuous thread of the music and that relationship to it. And so, you know, in the 90s, right, my relationship was, it was the commodification. It was very, very commodification based. It was transactional. You know, I'm going to show up and I'm going to get paid for my time. Thank you very much. You are correct in what you're getting at, and that is, you know, in that environment, in the doom and gloom of prison, you know, by striking up the conversation with this guitar, I found a liberation that I hadn't known before. And I'm not talking poetically. I'm talking very, very literally. And that is the ability to accompany myself as a musician. So prior to that moment, I was a rapper. I showed up and somebody would play the backing track and I would rap lyrics over it. And that felt good to me. And I did that at Radio City Music Hall. I did that at Carnegie Hall. And I did that at small little clubs around the world, and I was fine with that. But I always had to have a DJ, or I always had to have somebody. So it was in learning that guitar. My first song had two chords. Well, that's all you need. That's all you need. So it was off to the races from there.
Mm. So the reality is that people who do go to prison, and as I say, I've known people and so on, and there seems to be, you know, there's when you get there, there's a fork in the road. You can go right, you can go left. So you can hate everything and hate yourself, or you can look at yourself. I think those are two basic things. Now, I the other day was doing an intro to a Ram Dass podcast that we do, and in one part of it, he was talking about, actually, it was about work and money, and he was talking about the way you look at people that you're working with. If you look at them as other, and you're trying to get ahead, you got to defend yourself, somebody wants your job, you know, all that kind of thing, you know, you're pretty lost. You've got to work yourself back into where you see the soul in everybody. So he said, and a good example of this, although nothing to do with work, is that I used to work with prisoners. I used to go to prisons, and Ram Dass was involved in something called Prison Ashram Project, and they would provide supplies of spiritual books, this, that, and the other, Be Here Now. And he said at one point he was working with people on death row. And he said for many of them, that process brought them into that soul land that he talks about. And he would be sitting around with them doing loving kindness Buddhist meditation with these folks. And that is obviously really radical. You are going to, you know that you are going to lose your life. And to be able to move in that direction, I mean, is pretty spectacular, really. And there wasn't just a few, many, he said. And I think you were in prison for about 4 years, something like that?
No, more than seven.
Seven? Hmm. Somebody gave me the wrong info on that one. Seven. Jesus. But you did what Ram Dass was talking about, which is moved into the internal part of yourself and related and worked with that rather. I mean, am I suggesting stuff that wasn't real? I mean, I'm sure there was a process, but how did that work for you in terms of that length of time and pernicious atmosphere?
My prison experience it was a very, very clear lived exercise in relativity. I knew from the moment that I arrived through and up to the morning I left that my experience was largely my experience and was not going to be the general experience for others. And let me illustrate what I mean. Mail. I received mail in some shape, form, or fashion, a newspaper, periodical, letter, every day, with the exception of maybe five, over the course of the 7+ years that I was away. There were guys who would come to mail call sit on my left, sit on my right, day in and day out, and they wouldn't get one piece of mail. What's a piece of mail? It's a connection to the outside. It has your name on it. There's an expectation that you will receive it. It tethers you to that humanity that you're dreaming of returning to, that you're missing, that you're longing. So I also received lots of personal mail from friends as well as strangers. People telling me how much my music had impacted them, to hold on, to keep my head up, to don't lose faith. So I had so much hope. We had the appeals process until we didn't, but that appeals process gave me hope that lasted me for the first 4 years until the Supreme Court said, no, we're not gonna hear your case. And then, out of the corners of the universe, we heard whispers of there being one last sliver of hope. And that was now that the appeals process was exhausted, to consider filing for executive clemency, a presidential commutation or pardon. And this was during the Bush era. George W. Bush, who did not have a popular history with utilizing those powers. And like I said, that was, four years into my incarceration. So at the end of 2005. And in very, very large part due to the continued advocacy of a woman that I refer to as my spiritual godmother, Carly Simon. It was through her very, very public efforts that she was able to assemble a political coalition of folks who champion my early release. And on November the 24th, 2008, I found out that my name had made a very, very short list. And I was the recipient of a presidential commutation. And I came home December the 22nd, 2008. And I've been home for more than 12 years now.
Boy, do you look, just looking at the karma of that, and how it just turned you inside out, basically. And again, the connection with music seems to be the internal alchemy, right?
Well said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's just amazing. And then, fast forward. I mean, I never thought I'd hear from you. And so you're going to have to explain that out a little bit. But suddenly I'm watching a video of a song John did not that long ago, a year ago, I'm not sure, Gong Guru.
Well, the video, the original song that, you know, that I did, and when I released that video, I think that was, it might have been 2015, maybe 2016.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But what I didn't release it until last year in, you know, on my new album, Rhythm Drive. Yes.
Right. So suddenly I'm watching and listening, and there's this whole connectivity with Love, Serve, Remember and Ram Dass. And I'm going, what?
Love, Serve, Remember, May You Long Last and Be Here Now, Baba Ram Dass.
Yeah.
And then I say, fly high, reach that disc, eyes open, go deep, be that fish.
Mm,
you know, you're the fish down there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going deep.
Yeah. All right. Well, how do you meet up with Ram Dass, basically?
You know, I can't think about that without thinking about the adage that, you know, I heard that said, you know, our paths are deeply connected long before and after we meet. And I had been familiar with Ram Dass's likeness and even some of his words. Because I read Be Here Now when I was away. But it's like they say, timing is everything. And so you could be proximate to the messages, you could be right next to the woman giving the speech, but if you're not ready to hear it and to receive it, you might as well be across town and out of earshot. Mm. And so while I was aware, while the wisdom was on my radar for a number of years, it wasn't until, you know, 2015 that it really turned on for me. And there was a triumvirate of I'm not even gonna say it was a triumvirate because I was digging some of what Terrence McKenna was saying as well. So, you know, between Alan Watts, Abraham Hicks, Ram Dass, I was tuning into frequencies that felt really, really familiar time and time again. And so I'm seeking out these recordings, and, you know, the digital age has lots that we can throw rocks at, but the ability to be able to source information and good information is awesome. So I was able to find this library of this treasure trove of recordings, and I was transported. You know, I closed my eyes, I listened, I laughed along with the audience members. You know, I was in the room. And so me being a musician, but not just a musician, but a musician deeply rooted in the urban experience, I feel duty bound to take the stuff that makes me feel great and to put it to song so that others can also pick up on those ingredients, on those good feeling ingredients. And so I began very, very purposely and deliberately and with a whole lot of love, incorporating some of this wisdom into the music. And I remember very, very early on, a friend of mine got wind of it, and she called me like the day after I released the Gone Guru video, and she said, I'm sure I'm connected to somebody within the Ram Dass Foundation. You know, I could do a little bit of work, and we could make the link. And I said, well, that sounds like so much. I said, you know, if it's supposed to happen, it's going to happen. I said, this will find its way. And, you know, part of that grace is getting out of the way. Like, once you create it, Now you just gotta pivot and say thank you and let it go, and I let that go, and I'll tell you, I was so surprised when I was happily surprised when I got a message from our mutual friend who had heard what you heard and she saw what you saw, and she said, "Did you say Ram Dass in a song? And if is there any, you know, I'd love to connect you." And that felt a lot easier. It felt a lot easier this time, you know, a few years later. Mm. And, you know, one thing led to the other. And now I'm added to the lineup, which feels amazing. And I'm psyched. I'm just psyched to be here.
But let me just say something. I mean, before we got on live, I said to John, now, I don't want to be a gushy little guy here around. So I've heard the new music that John's been creating. There'll be an album that'll come out this year, and you're all going to hear about it one way or the other. I mean, it's really, really pretty great. But when you started talking about wanting to share through your vehicle some of what you have that's brought forth out of all of this experience, the experience incarceration, the experience of some of the things that you were just bound to find through grace. Now, so some people get angry at me because I get a little bit, I'm not so happy about New Age stuff, okay? when people are put into songs, the most all of this spiritual verbiage, which is so direct, and it feels like fundamentalism to me almost, you know. And I just tell you, you will all be so pleased to hear real poetry that reflects real wisdom, okay, in a way that it's just spectacular, okay? So I did my gushy thing. I can't help it.
Thank you, Raghu. Thank you.
It is real. By the way, I mean, listening, so much a part, I'm sure you realize this, but so much a part of many of the songs, these new songs. I mean, it's terrible we're talking about music. I hate talking about music without playing something. Can we play at least the Ganguru song? Are we allowed to do that?
Yeah, for sure.
Because you have control over it, right? I won't mm-hmm. get hit mm-hmm. by Warner Brothers or anything.
No, no. Okay. Will you play it? Will you splice it into this conversation?
Yeah, right here. Right now, here you go, just so you all know what we're talking about. Here's Ganguru.
Transform, don't sleep unless you need that dip. Live without apologizing, be that rich. Get in line, get well, get rhythm. Get used to good living, yeah. It's like a line to a lemon. We've been here before, you just need to remember. It's like a lemon to a lime, it's revealed over time. The signs and the symbols, the cracks in the asphalt, stash in the dashboard, world in my palms, hacky sack with my passport.
So good. I felt like we were in radio just then. That's amazing.
Yeah, right. But you know, breath is so much a part of this new record, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It really is. And it is the thing. It's the meditation practice that I have been doing all these years since I was first in India, which is Vipassana, which is around just following your breath, the natural breath through the rising and falling of your abdomen, or in and out of the feeling it in and out of the nostrils. And breath to me is the great equalizer in terms of bringing you back to the be here now moment, for sure. So you have it all over this album. Maybe the album, you need a poetic name, but Breathe, MF, come on.
I'm going to take that into consideration because I don't have a name just yet. So we're close.
And by the way, here's just, I don't even know which song this is from. And this is so totally an aside. The truth is subjective. That's why I choose herb for breakfast. I don't know where it's from, which song or anything.
That's from the new album.
It is.
Okay, from a song called Build. Yes. The truth is subjective.
Everybody, when I'm talking about John being able to wordsmith in a way that just wakes you up and connects you to what the reality is. And this is, so here's a line, find your wings. Okay. Find your wings, but until then, get under mine. You know what that is? Ram Dass just wrote a book with Mirabai Bush, or Mirabai wrote it with Ram Dass, called Walking Each Other Home. That is walking each other home, just with a different twist, right? That made me so happy because that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about for all of us. That's what happened to me when I met Ram Dass. The way that he shared with me space when at the first second that I saw him, I was a running a rock and roll station in Montreal. And I don't know if you know, if you've listened to podcasts, you might know the story, but otherwise it's just, can you announce he's doing a talk at McGill University, the big school there? And I go, what? Who's Ram Dass? What? And they go, oh, Tim Leary, Richard Alpert. Oh, God, I loved them. He was eating acid at the time. And then, but you got to have a talk, send it over. And they sent over a talk, and that was, oh, God, yeah. Everything was like, oh, man, I had been waiting to hear. My first guru is John Coltrane, okay? Because I was lucky enough to get into I don't know how I did it at 15 years old or something, because it was booze, you know, but somehow somebody got me in there and I went out of my body and my favorite things. I don't know if you've ever
seen. You saw John live when you were 15?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Talk about grace. Wow. I mean, because I went out of my body in that moment when he's played have you heard this? I'm sure you've heard this song. I mean, it's just.
And well, I mean, I also I can't think about John without thinking about Alice and then thinking about.
And what she's doing. Yeah.
Oh,
has done.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah. Yes. So.
Cosmic.
Yeah. So really that without that, I don't know where I would be. And then, of course, the trust I had with Ram Dass led me to India. And of course, Neem Karoli Baba, which that's a whole other conversation we'll have on another day, I'm sure.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. There's so much more. It's just, I especially like how you, one thing you talked about with Tlaib that was around grace and dignity. Can you just talk about that just for, I know we're kind of at the end of our session, but I just want to hear from you about how that rings for you. And I mean, because it, I think it's a major, major thing.
There was a time when I was in prison and I was doing my job as an orderly, cleaning out the trash bins, mopping, sweeping, custodial work. And I was down on my knees and I was cleaning out replacing the trash can with a new bag, having just wrapped it up in this corrections officer. He was standing in a threshold and he said, what's it like? And I said, what? He says, what's it like to be? He said, what's it like to go from being on stage and being a hot shot to cleaning out my trash? And I said in that moment, I said, well, I know this is temporary. And I said, right now, I'm going to do the best job that I have to do. But I knew that was temporary. And I didn't take umbrage with I just didn't feel that spiritual assault. If anything, I felt compassion for him because I knew that while it was temporary for me, that it would be less temporary for him. And that sort of job security came from a not great feeling place, supported by lots of ill-feeling thoughts, right? Because the prison industrial complex is another construct. And so we invest in it. We invest in it. We believe in it to the degree that it's convenient for us until one day, and this day will come, we see what that environment really tells us about ourselves. So going through that taught me that no matter where I would be, that my dignity was my power. My dignity was my power. I wasn't going to be subjected to anyone's belief system. So on the one side, there's that, and that's what kept me upright. But grace is what keeps me in motion, because that's how I'm responding to what's beyond my control. And rather than being stressed out, rather than being angry, rather than being bitter, which, again, are all within my tool belt of tricks, I'm like, you know what? Not today. And that to me is that's grace.
Ram Dass said the same thing when he got the stroke, by the way, after, you know, years after, when he came to realize, well, Fierce Grace, that wonderful movie, was all about that. But for a long time, he thought, okay, the Fierce Grace was his guru gave him the stroke. And he went to India one day, and we have when Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji left, a woman saint who had been with him named Siddhi Ma for forever, she became our Indian mother for all practical purposes, as well as being an exalted being. But Ram Dass went there just before he ended up in 2004. He went to India for the first time since, you know, he had the stroke in 98, I think. And she knew that he had this whole thing, that he was given the stroke by Maharaji, so then he could become who he was supposed to become. She said, no one, he doesn't give strokes. Nature gave you the stroke. What the grace was that you were able to see it and to transform it. And she didn't say it in those words because she was speaking in Hindi, but basically said the same thing. That nature, in other words, whatever his physical, I mean, Ram Dass wasn't taking care of himself, actually, in the years just before he got that stroke, in terms of overweight and kind of food he was eating and so on, and not taking blood pressure medicine, I think. And then, yes, he realized that he was given the grace of being able to see the truth about who he was at that moment, and being able to finally get to what he was pointing to all those years, which was love everyone, serve everyone, remember God. So same as what you just expressed. Absolutely the same. I thank you so much for being here.
And thank you sharing. So much. I was looking forward to this conversation. I'm looking forward to more, but this was very, very special.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, everybody. Again, we'll be able to get with John on the 30th of April in our Ram Dass Soul Land series, available on all the platforms, social media, and ramdass.org. And I am sure way beyond that, because whatever he can handle of us bugging him to take part in this, that, and the other, we will be doing that. And okay, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and enjoy the plethora of amazing podcasts and teachers and thought leaders. And we're adding Alan Watts, John. How about that?
Mind blown. Well,
we have that great thing we did as an experiment, choosing themes and using some of Alan's work and Ram Dass back and forth. That's if you haven't checked that out, it's probably the one. I think there's a new one going up today, but yeah, Alan Watts and Ram Dass. So that's
most certainly will. That's how I'll set the scene and setting in the studio right now before I get into some music making.
Yeah. All right, great. And we will see you all next week. Okay. Namaste. Boom, boom, boom. See you later.